Welcome to Transcribed, Benchling's podcast where leaders share their personal journeys and hard-won lessons driving scientific progress. Today's guest is Andrew Bellinger, a physician scientist whose career traces the full arc of translational medicine. He's treated patients as a cardiologist, co-founded Lindra Therapeutics from his postdoc research, and helped bring Verve's base editing technology into the clinic as CSO. Through it all, he's taken on some of the hardest challenges in medicine, turning first-in-class science into breakthroughs that fundamentally change the patient experience.
Andrew, thanks for joining us on Transcribed.
Love to be here.
Let's start with Verve. Verve was founded in 2018, and in 7 years, Verve advanced 3 in vivo gene editing products, including 2 to the clinic, and is now being acquired by Eli Lilly. At launch, Verve was distinctively focused on a single therapeutic area at a moment in time when basically every new kind of hot biotech out of the gates was building a platform. It's hard to remember now, but like that was a very contrarian decision at the time. Can you talk more about like what Verve's mission was and the founding of Verve and the decision to go focused on a single therapeutic area?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I'd like to take full credit for the brilliance of being a product-centric company, but there were some structural factors that played into it. Verve, as you know, was founded on the principle that we were going to develop in vivo gene editing medicines for cardiovascular disease. This was also a very contrarian bet, because at the time, gene editing and gene therapy more generally was primarily for rare diseases. The concept that you could apply it to a common disease was sort of hard to believe. People thought we were crazy for a couple of reasons. One, people didn't believe that gene editing, this brand new technology that had just been invented, that patients and even doctors might be comfortable using it for a common disease. Mm-hmm. And two, common diseases already have some therapies. They may not work all that well sometimes, but we have therapy options. And so
sure,
the idea that
statins for cardiovascular disease.
Exactly. Yeah. So the idea that you would use gene editing for a common disease that has alternative therapies was controversial. This concept that we were going to be the in vivo gene editing for common disease company forced us to make a couple decisions. One was these development programs were going to be a little bit bigger, which meant we probably couldn't do 10 of them.
Oh, just because of cost. Yeah.
Just because of cost. We were going to have to be more focused. And two, it actually was structural. Like the company was founded with 4 targets that we were going to be focused on, all cardiovascular targets. And we only had a license to the base editing technology from Beam Therapeutics for those 4 targets. Hmm. So in some ways, it was a function of necessity. We only had IP for those 4 targets. So we didn't have the option of being a platform that could go after, 100 rare diseases. We were made that bet right at the founding to be that kind of a focus, product focused company. It's also the case that I had spent the 5 years before that working on a platform technology. And so
the pendulum already swung for you.
I was well aware of some of the challenges with that. But I think it's to the founder's credit that, say Kath Rayson and GV and the other teams involved that they were going to go after a problem, not after a technology.
Was there ever pressure to go broader or to expand as the company, reached certain milestones and kind of became its own?
Yeah. And we did. I mean, the pressure came from, to a degree, from the public and from investors, right? So one of the criticisms of Verve publicly was that we didn't have a platform and that, that limited the upside in some sense. Our counter argument was that we were treating the most common disease in the world.
Number one cause of death.
Atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. As one of our founders like to say, if all we do is cure coronary disease, we've done enough.
Yeah.
That's enough.
That's challenge. Pretty ambitious.
Yeah. 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 So, but we did, we did end up broadening focus over time. and adding layering on programs, including programs outside of those four targets, you know, in other areas.
But still all focused on cardiovascular disease, right?
Not entirely. Actually, we ended up with partnering a program with Vertex that was for a serious liver condition, not cardiovascular. And I think, you know, that they were more layered on and only after we had establish the company. And I think, you know, it kind of gets at a broader point about that tension between product and platform.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about that. Like, how should the industry biotech entrepreneurs think about platform versus as products? It feels like a pendulum that just like swings back and forth. And again, when Verve was founded, platform is distinctly in fashion. And today it's like a bad word.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think it's, for me, it's a little bit more nuanced. I have like a preferred path, but maybe it's useful before I say that to kind of articulate some of the challenges with platform. I mean, the fundamental challenge with a platform approach is that you, without the clarifying focus of a product, you have this tendency to just kind of build capabilities that, you know, you think or hope will eventually lead to a product. But that creates all kinds of misaligned incentives. So my my kind of advice, you know, in how to resolve the tension is usually the reality is if you're developing even one product, you have to build an awful lot of platform behind it. Certainly we did at Verve. Mm-hmm. We built a ton of platform capabilities, but it was all geared towards product development.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of came from a driver out of the products. And I think that that's kind of the mental model that I kind of advocated for at Verve, which was focus the entire company on one thing at first. Along the way, as you do that, you're going to build a lot of capabilities that allow you to scale and potentially go in other directions. And you can make kind of careful decisions about when and how to do that. But if you start the company and really focus it at the beginning on one product, you'll build the muscles that will eventually allow you to do more. And I think in the tech world, this is actually,
yeah. I find this really interesting because in the tech world, if you ever start saying you're building a platform, people will be like, okay, cool. But like it's every great platform has come out of a killer application and you back the platform out over time. And the application earns you permission to keep going on the platform.
Right. I mean, a favorite saying of mine from Amy Schulman actually is, you know, you need to earn the right to take the next step.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's...
Do you think like entrepreneurs are just too scared of like seeming narrow by going after a single product and they think investors want them to say, we're going to take over the world with this amazing platform that will cure all disease or something?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, sort of the, you know, you don't have to have conviction in that first program if you can do anything.
Yeah. I guess in a sort of low interest rate world with a lot of capital, maybe that works. But then in nowadays, like it is no chance of being successful.
I think it's
successful.
Also, you know, it's a, you know, particularly in the gene therapy and gene editing world where a lot of companies are going after rare diseases, the commercial opportunity of their first product sometimes doesn't actually justify the effort.
Yeah.
And so they have to believe that if I do this, you know, this easy problem first, then I can do this harder problem later.
So a different version of earning permission, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And I think that logic, you know, has merit. I mean, there's definitely truth to that. We were fortunate at Verve in that our initial programs, we were able to develop one product with and have a clinical development plan that let us do that. Meaning we could go after a rare disease first and then take the same drug and actually would work in broader conditions.
I see.
That's a very fortunate position.
Sure, you carved off a piece of like the broader cardiovascular health problem.
Right. People with a genetic underlying risk or condition that increases their risk, those people are the natural people to treat first.
Sure, actual unmet medical versus going straight at statins or something for the mass population.
Competing with the kind of the most broad population.
Yeah. That makes sense. So one of the reasons I was really excited to have this conversation is I know a lot of people who have worked at Verve and in sort of like different roles. And many people have told me that Verve is one of the best run biotech companies that they've ever worked at. And Verve went from, if I recall correctly, founding to clinical trials in just 4 years, which by biotech standards is fast, but it's unbelievably fast when you consider the fact that this was a brand new modality. What made Verve so special, either from an operational or strategic standpoint? And do you have any anecdotes about like what helped Verve move so fast?
Well, thank you. Very kind. I don't think it was any one thing. We had a really strong initial leadership team of, say, Kathiresan, the CEO, Andrew Ash, who is the chief operating officer and president, and me as leading R&D. And I think that, you know, a strong kind of initial leadership team makes a big difference. I would come back to focus. I mean, I think focus was critical in kind of moving fast. It also was critical in building a culture that was very results oriented. What I mean by that is, I think nothing can kind of undermine an organization and a culture more than people having uncertainty about what the priorities are or why they're working on something. I mean, that has a pervasive effect. So I think that played a role. The other is hiring. You know, Sake and I both interviewed every single applicant for the first 150 positions.
Okay. 150 hires.
Which is
CEO, CSO, head of R&D doing the interviews still.
Yeah. 100%. That's, 150 hires, that might be 1,000 applicants, right, over the first few years. And we continued actually after that. You know, Verve is 285-ish people today. We continued to interview almost everybody after that.
Why did you do that?
Yeah. Right. So, what we told ourselves is that there is no higher value function that executives can do than hiring well. But I think it's actually a little bit more than just hiring well. I think it's also about the messages that you send to the organization by doing that.
Oh, I bet every single person coming in felt like an extra, almost like loyalty or higher purpose, knowing that the like founder, the CEO, the head of R&D had all personally interviewed them.
Yeah, I mean, people would come and be like, I've never interviewed a research associate, be like, I've never interviewed with a CEO or a CSO before in my career. I've been at 10 companies, never interviewed with them before. And what it says to the applicants is, you're important. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's we care, we want to know you, we want to hear from you, we want to, we think it's important that we hire talent well. What it says to the organization as well is, it prioritizes quality, mm-hmm. right? The tension for hiring, especially when you're hiring fast, is often, oh, I really need this person. I need help.
Sure.
I need
I'm
help
sure,
doing my
I'm sure
job.
The organization looked at you and Sake as a bottleneck sometimes.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. But in a way that actually, I think, highlighted that, cultural factors, emotional intelligence, like we cared. That was what we were interviewing for. We're doing behavioral interviewing. Mm-hmm. We weren't interviewing for technical skills. So, it highlighted that, to the organization that they couldn't just sneak somebody through because they really needed help with some problem that they needed to solve. We were gonna pay attention.
Oh, wow. And did it affect even like the types of roles that Verve hired for?
Yeah. I mean, I think, I guess another, you sort of asked about organizational, what made the organization work. I think one of the things that I believe in very strongly is that the performance of an organization has a lot to do with kind of the, not just the people you bring in, but how you put them together, mm-hmm. What the...
Like the org chart?
The org chart or just how you kind of construct the organization. And I think one of the mistakes that a lot of early biotechs make is trying to build an org chart, a leadership team, based on what they think a biotech should look like. This idea of we should have these C-suite executives, we should have these vice presidents and these functions, and they should report in this way. Often it's trying to make a biotech, a 20-person biotech, look like a pharma company, which is insane when you say it like that. But the temptation is real. And actually, there's a lot of pressure to do that. You know,
where's the pressure come from? Investors?
Investors, yeah. Okay. Investors want to see a mature organization, right? What we did at Verve was a little different. We, again, we were focused on one product at first, right? We were going to make one thing. And so we built basically a project team. It wasn't an org built to look like a pharma company. It was a project team, which meant a very flat organization. We hired people who were really strong in their domains, you know, put them together so that they could just focus on moving the project forward rather than on building fiefdoms, rather than building capabilities. I mean, it kind of ended up tying into the platform idea, because there was no incentive to build, you know, some large team to go build capabilities to do something incredibly well. You were all just trying to make a product. And I think that played a big role in our ability to kind of move fast, but also to maintain a very mission-driven culture of people who were focused on, you know, advancing the goal of developing this really challenging new modality for a huge problem in the world.
Wow. Let's talk about that new modality piece. So Verve was the first to bring base editing to the clinic, which is a big milestone. You in the past mentioned paying this like pioneer's tax. What is that? And like, what were some of the biggest challenges you faced, expected or not, with navigating regulation or regulatory authorities, the regulatory authority for a brand new modality?
Yeah. I mean, the first challenge was just that everyone thought we were crazy.
Sure.
Right. So, you know, in Silicon Valley, maybe everyone's a pioneer. but in biotech, being a pioneer is not necessarily a good thing. Investors, regulators, they like things that are precedented. Mm-hmm. They like to say, oh, I can see the path for that. I know how to do that. When you're doing something that's never been done before, everyone has lots of questions and says, you know, this looks really hard.
There are a lot of reasons it could not work.
Yeah. And in biotech is, you know, I mean, it's really hard and it's so easy to fail. So when you make it even harder by doing something in a new way, you're just upping the ante for investors and for regulators. So let me make that a little more tangible. I mean, I think when we submitted the first IND for an in vivo gene editing medicine to the FDA, and we submitted the first IND, when you see something new like that, you suddenly have to think about all the implications.
Sure, the regulator has never done this before, so they don't even know what they're looking for, I assume.
That's right. They don't have a playbook. And so, you know, that could be, you know, it can raise kind of scientific questions. It can also even raise policy questions. And in our case, in vivo gene editing raised this kind of profound policy question of, is it possible that you, in editing the patient in front of you, could be editing future generations of humanity?
That's a little bit scary when it's phrased like that.
When you phrase it like that. And the FDA, understandably, had a lot of questions and actually, you know, was uncertain even about what the bar for that should be. Is that risk need to be 0.001%? Or does it have to be zero? And how do you prove a 0% risk? What's the experiment that you can run that will say...
How long is it going to take?
That will say that can't happen. So, you know, when you submit the first, you know, IND, you know, you have to tackle all those issues in real time. So today, you know, just 3 or 4 years later, when a company submits an IND for in vivo gene editing medicine, the FDA has thought about these issues now. And so there is a playbook of how you handle this. And companies are routinely now navigating it without too much struggle. But when you're the first, you pay that tax.
Sure. Because... You get to the FDA and like the goalposts could move because you don't even really know the goalposts.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Wow. Those other companies owe you big time.
Yes.
You know, a few years ago, people were comparing gene editing to the Motorola bag phone era. I had to look this up because I thought it was a mistake. I was like, what's a bag phone? I thought maybe this is someone meant flip phone. And I'm not that young. So, you know, promising, but very early. What do you think the iPhone moment for gene editing looks like? And did we just see it with Kieran, one of the Verve co-founders, and the treatment of baby KJ Muldoon?
Yeah. First of all, I'm incredibly proud of Kieran and for what he's accomplished with baby KJ. I think that it definitely has captured the public mind in a way that other moments haven't.
Yeah.
Which I think highlights, again, the narrative power of a story.
And yeah. Biotech and pharma can do a little bit better when it comes to narratives and storytelling.
Yeah. A simple single person sometimes tells a story better than
way better
than a crowd or a number. I think that the hype cycle kind of
sure is bag phone iPhone even the right comparison?
Yeah,
like
I don't know.
Where are we?
I
mean, yeah,
maybe I would say baby KJ is sort of a moment where people are reassessing, was the pessimism of the last few years overdone?
Pendulum swung too far, maybe.
Maybe.
Because right now, I think like getting a gene editing company funded is probably like very few entrepreneurs are getting up and saying, I'm going to start a gene editing company.
Some of them are still trying, but I don't know that investors are writing checks. But I don't know that that's the iPhone moment. Mm-hmm. I think the iPhone moment will come when the first commercial success of a gene editing therapy really takes off. I think that's sort of the analogy to the iPhone is when people discover that the demand is there in a way that they didn't realize.
Yeah.
That's really the story of iPhone is that, it was launched and suddenly the demand was enormous.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's what gene editing needs is that realization that actually patients and doctors too are going to embrace this in a way that, I think everyone is cautious in thinking about how this is going to, play out. And
do you think the gene editing products need to get 10x better or like
10x? Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think we haven't seen that product yet. Mm-hmm. If you ask me to kind of predict, I think the alpha-1 antitrypsin programs that several companies in the field have the potential for being that moment. It's a disease with, essentially no treatment options right now, can be very severe, impacts a lot of people.
Okay, so big enough patient population, unmet medical need, not a lot of good options. Yeah.
And the therapies really work.
Okay.
They look like they're going to work. And so I can see that being a moment where, the generalist investors that have really moved away from gene editing in a profound way over the last few years see that this technology can impact, a lot of patients and actually be commercially viable, which, to date, I think the programs, that has been a pretty strong bear thesis that, even if you figure out the science and get it to work really well, is it really gonna have, a commercial impact on patients and on the bottom line?
Let's talk about Lyndra, the company you co-founded and ran for a while before Verve. So during your cardiology fellowship, you did a postdoc in Bob Langer's lab, which led to, I believe, co-founding Lyndra Therapeutics. Do you always plan on becoming an entrepreneur, and or was the science just so compelling you had to see it out? Like, what was the transition like from kind of postdoc academic lab in medicine and to research to industry?
Yeah, I think everyone who goes and spends time in Bob Langer's lab is motivated because they want their you know, efforts, their inventions, their thoughts to have an impact. Hmm. I think that's kind of a unifying feature of Bob's lab.
That's kind of, I like the like self-fulfilling nature of that. It like attracts more people who want to have an impact and kind of begets itself.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, in hindsight, that decision to go work with Bob was an indication that I was certainly open to the idea of transitioning. I will say it kind of surprised my wife quite a bit. Okay. She did not expect me to stop being a doctor eventually. Okay. And become an entrepreneur. So you know, I don't think it was an obvious.
So were you seeing patients at the time? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I continued to see patients for a long time after, mm-hmm. after kind of transitioning the bulk of my effort to biotech, probably another 7 or 8 years. I only gave it up a few years ago, kind of in the middle tail end of the pandemic, largely because it was becoming increasingly challenging to kind of navigate that while also leading a public.
Yeah.
Public
I can't imagine that. So Lindra founding story, was the,
yeah, I think, you know, we had a really interesting solution to a problem, which is, you know, adherence of oral therapies is really poor. And we had developed this long-acting oral technology in the Langer lab. And the question was, is this a commercially viable strategy? And could we make it in a way that would work in humans? And I don't think it was obvious. We actually spent a long time, you know, Bob and I and Gio Traverso and actually Amy Schulman, who was brought in from Polaris, mm-hmm. One of the partners at Polaris, to help us think about this. Spent a long time kind of mulling over if this was going to be a developable drug. And eventually we decided it was. And, you know, very grateful to Amy for that decision, and to come in and lead it with me. I mean, she was the first CEO, I was the CSO, and, you know, I was essentially a cardiologist with very limited experience in industry at the time. So she took a big chance on me. And we, you know, built the company and, you know, as you know, got several programs into the clinic.
Yeah, I believe 25 drug candidates, 12 clinical trials completed with Lindra.
Yeah. And I think we accomplished a lot in moving the technology forward. You know, it. I think the sort of through line, if you're, you know, looking for a through line between, well, mm-hmm. you know, is in thinking about these problems of like how hard it is to be a patient. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really a profound thing that we don't always do a great job of thinking about. We're very focused on.
Sure, it's very easy to get absorbed in the technology and the science and like forget at the end of the day, like a patient's got to take the drug.
That's right. And, you know, what's their experience of it? What's their experience of their condition, their disease, and the condition of kind of taking the medicine even? Like, you know, is it the example that has always stuck in my mind is talking to a patient who told me once, I asked him why he wasn't taking his medicine. He'd had a heart attack already, and asked him why he wasn't taking his medicine to prevent another heart attack. And he told me, every time I see that pill bottle and have to take my medicine, I'm reminded of the heart attack and I feel sick. It reminds me that I'm sick.
Oh.
And this just has stuck with me ever since. A profound example of how differently patients can think about medicine from how we think about it as doctors or drug developers. That for them, you know, they're very focused on their lives, mm-hmm. and living their lives as well as they can. which they should be, right? Yeah. That's what they should be thinking about. And we're thinking about, you know, well, did you take your medicine today?
Yeah. I love that anecdote. You led Lyndra from kind of early concept in the lab to phase one clinical trials. What told you it was time to for your next chapter and that Verve was it? I think for an entrepreneur having to, like, that was probably your baby, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this may sound a little kind of insecure, I guess, but when you have a baby and you've built this company, you've founded it, you've grown it, and this maybe is not true for everybody, but for me, I had this kind of question in the back of my mind: did I get really lucky? Like, could I do this again? Mm. Is it, or is that was my one shot at kind of success? And so I'm somebody who's very motivated by having a chip on my shoulder, I think, in a constructive way. I hope. But I think the idea of doing it again was really appealing. It kind of proving to myself that I could. The question of, like, why Verve? Well, I can't tell. I mean, I'm pretty passionate about the idea that this kind of approach really changes the relationship between doctor and patient and medicine and patient. A one-time gene editing therapy that can lower your risk of cardiovascular disease for the rest of your life, potentially. That's a profound concept. It's not even just about the data and, you know, how well does it work. It's actually a change in the way we think about medicine.
Sure, it'll change that patient's relationship with medicine. Yeah.
And it kind of creates a model where you can think about, I mean, we've thought about these gene therapies, one-time therapies, in the context of cures for, you know, horrible diseases. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the mental model that most people have for gene editing and gene therapy. But you can envision a different world model where one-time therapies become kind of like almost a preventive molecular surgery that you get to prevent future diseases. And that's a
radical concept.
It's a radical concept. Yeah. Now, you know, are we there? No. Are we there? Are we going to be there in 5 years, 10 years? Probably not.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea of Verve was so profound that
you just had to work on it.
had to work on it. Yeah. I mean, I think the phrase I remember distinctly saying to myself is, this has the potential to be the most important advance in cardiovascular disease care in the next 50 years.
You have to take the shot if you see
something. You have to take the shot. Yeah. Once you make that statement in your head, you know,
everything else probably seems completely unimportant that you could work on. Yeah. 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 I love that. Maybe more of an emotional question. Lyndra wound down this year due to the tough funding environment. Like, what was your reaction? How did it make you feel?
Well, I mean, biotech is a really hard business. Mm-hmm. A lot of things have to go right for a company to be successful. Mm-hmm. It's not just about whether the technology works or the drug works. Maintaining consistent funding momentum through ups and downs of cycles is super challenging. And maintaining kind of continuity of people and governance by the board and investors is also really challenging. And so, you know, it makes me a little sad, especially for the just incredible effort that so many people put into Lyndra, you know, over 10 years, you know, 10 plus years. You know, that mainly just that there wasn't a way. I mean, the financial return obviously is not good for folks, but mainly I wish that the technology and the effort and the progress that was made could have found a home. I think that would have been a more satisfying outcome, mm-hmm. even if it hadn't been a great financial return for anyone. It would have been nice if it found a home, and it's unfortunate that it kind of wound down the way it did. But you know, sometimes things don't work out the way you hope.
Let's talk more about, I mean, we talked about gene editing today. Let's talk about more about, like, science today broadly. You were a clinician scientist, you became an entrepreneur. So you've kind of seen a lot of aspects of the life science industry, academic research, drug discovery, patient care, and you're a Columbia graduate. What's your reaction and kind of parsing of what's going on with the current administration and the cuts to scientific agencies and kind of the pressure on universities today? Small question.
Yeah. Well, I think multiple things can be true at the same time. It is the case that there was a lot of need for reform, has been a lot of need for reform in the way academic science is done. There's a lot of administrative bloat. There's a lot of kind of regulatory capture and rent seeking across the ecosystem. And I think that, you know, there was a lot of need for change. Unfortunately, the change that we're getting is in the, optimistically, I'll call it creative destruction model. Mm-hmm. The idea that if we break everything, then, you know, 1,000 flowers will bloom and a new model will magically appear. I think I worry that the process is, you know, science doesn't, you can't turn it off and turn it on very quickly.
Yeah.
It's a very sort of slow accretion of knowledge, slow accretion of training and experience of humanity. I mean,
in the US probably compounding it since like the post-World War II era.
That's right. And this kind of disruption that we're seeing has the potential to really have kind of profound negative repercussions that are not going to last for 6 months or a year of slowdown in funding.
Yeah, we might not even know them for some time, right?
Right, that's right. And so that's what I worry about. I think that the transitory shocks right now are distressing, and certainly on an individual level can be very harmful for a lot of the scientists who are impacted. But the more kind of structural impacts are what kind of worry me a little bit for mm-hmm. the longer term, that it really takes a risk off mentality that is not going to lead to creative destruction and blooming of 1,000 flowers. It's going to lead to a pretty profound shrinking of the ambition of science in America.
Which is a very hard thing to measure. Yeah.
It's unfortunate that it's happening at a moment in time when biotech and industry in general is not in a position to really absorb the impact. Mm. Had we been in a different moment in the cycle when this happened, I think there would have been more potential for private industry to kind of step in and buffer some of the impacts, maybe create some of that creative destruction mm-hmm. Opportunities. We happen to be at a moment where industry is pulling back and becoming less ambitious at the same time that the academic and government funded scientific enterprises is hurting. And that's there's not a lot of easy solutions for that.
Yeah, that's a difficult thing to overcome. Success in biotech to me is both about taking big risks and also the learning from great mentors. You mentioned, Amy from Polaris and your first company. It sounds like she was like a really important mentor for you. Can you talk more about her and like great, great mentors and the impact they've had on you?
Yeah, I could list a half dozen people and say with confidence, I would not be here today without them. Mentors play such an important role in most entrepreneurs' experience. I think a lot of people think of mentors as people who can help you and open doors, create opportunity for you. And that's certainly true. And Amy is a great example of that. She took a chance on me. I don't even know what she saw that made her do that, but she did, and I'm incredibly grateful to her for that. But it's actually not what I'm most grateful to her for. The thing that I'm most grateful to her for is all the negative feedback she gave me.
Any examples you care to share?
Yeah. It's a funny thing to say, because I think, you know, we're sort of taught, you know, management 101, give more positive feedback than negative feedback. But Amy, she profoundly changed, you know, my leadership style, who I am, even teaching me about leadership, about emotional intelligence, about you know, how to think like an investor, how to think like a pharma executive, how to communicate. Profound sort of changes in my trajectory, I think. And you know, all that negative feedback.
we're talking like hands-on, like
hands-on. Yeah. So I mean, the example I'd give is, I, you know, one of the first pitches I did to a pharma company with Amy. You know, she had come out of, she had worked in Pfizer in a very, very senior role, general counsel, leading the vaccine and consumer groups and oncology groups at one point, and is a lawyer by training. Gifted business development executive. Here I am, scientist, basically, with
fresh out of the Langer lab.
Fresh out of the Langer lab, and I'm pitching a pharma company. And we go in, we do a 40-minute pitch that, you know, I'm doing most of the talking about the technology and the science and the programs and how we could collaborate with them. And then we get out of the meeting, 40-minute meeting, and Amy sits me down, and for 90 minutes, like 90. Twice as long as the meeting itself, she gives me detailed notes about everything I did wrong. You said this. They asked this question. You shouldn't have said that. Don't ever say that again. Like, you know, very detailed feedback about how I answered questions. And, you know, people always ask, you know, what's the biggest mistake scientists make in talking? The biggest mistake they make, and Amy drilled this into me over and over and over again, is they don't answer the question first.
Yep. Like,
and it's so repetitive mistake that scientists make. They don't answer the question.
Just answer
first.
The question.
Answer the question, and then you can say whatever you want afterwards, but yeah. Answer the question first. And Amy beat that kind of stuff into me, and, you know, honestly broke me down a bit. You know, I took away a lot of confidence, and then gradually built it back up again. And all that negative feedback, I mean, it's just, I'm profoundly grateful, because what I have seen, you know, learned with more maturity and time is what an investment that was by her in me as a person.
Yeah, feedback is a gift, and it is hard. It takes time.
It takes time. I mean, it's a gift, absolutely, but it was just an amazing amount of emotional and mental energy and time that she invested in telling me what I was doing wrong.
Yeah, it would have been much easier not to make it someone else's problem.
Yeah.
Wow. Thanks for sharing. You've touched so many different technologies and therapeutic areas at this point. Cocoon Biotech, which I didn't know about, developing silkworm protein for drug delivery at Lyndra, long-acting oral drugs to replace daily pills, Verve, developing gene therapies for cardiovascular disease, and now Corner Therapeutics to activate dendritic cells for durable immunity against cancer. You used the word through line earlier. What is the through line? Like, have you always been about following the science and impact? Like, what keeps you going?
It's less about the science of individual targets or biology pathways, and much more about just thinking differently about how we alter the patient experience of illness. And so, you know, you think about those different stories, gene editing, obviously. We've talked about long-acting oral medicines for things like schizophrenia. These are, very challenging disorders, opiate use disorder. In the case of Corner Therapeutics, it's, you know, cancer vaccines, which is it's one of these concepts that was very exciting, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. It kind of fell out of favor. I think we're going to see a resurgence of it over the next few years as we see some new data coming from some of these new approaches. these have, you know, cancer vaccine is, you just say the words, and I mean, again, maybe politically out of favor right now, but
the B word, yeah.
But the idea that you could, you know, give somebody a therapy that either prevents progression of a cancer or treats the cancer as a vaccine that could be administered, you know, one part of the body but work throughout the whole body. It's just a powerful concept that, you know, it's those kind of ideas that I think motivate me to tackle hard problems. I'd also say, you know, all of them are hard problems, and one kind of saying that's always resonated with me is from Ben Horowitz, who, like, you know, in his book, Hard Thing About Hard Things.
Great book.
Great book. That hard problems have this tendency to attract the best people to them because they come together with a mission to solve a hard problem. An easy problem is not going to attract the best people to it. Hard problems are what bring the best people together.
Yeah, they want to be challenged. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up with some lightning round. Fun questions. Just rapid fire. Say whatever comes to mind. Few words. No wrong answers. What's the most game-changing medicine of the last 100 years?
Cardiologist. I'm like so tempted to say statins. I'm going to give you GLP-1s.
I love it. I agree.
It's a bandwagon answer, but I think that these are going to change sort of the human condition.
I agree. You can wave your wand and have a cure for anything. I think I know what it's going to be, but what would it be?
Alzheimer's.
Yeah. What is something about you that people would be surprised to learn?
After college, I didn't feel ready to go to grad school. I was very insulated, unworldly. And so I took a job teaching high school in Rome.
Oh, wow.
Teaching high school is not like an obvious choice, but it was a great experience, getting me out of my comfort zones in a lot of different ways, forcing me to communicate with, you know, a bunch of 14 and 15 year old kids.
How's your Italian now?
Not good. Okay. I like to say I can order food at a restaurant. That's about it. I got by, and it was a great experience to just travel and kind of grow up a little bit.
Cool. What is something you were obsessed with as a child?
I like to build things. I was definitely a builder, and I'd build these really complex structures out of all kinds of different things. I wanted to be an architect when I was a kid. Except I couldn't pronounce architect.
Okay.
I would tell people when I was 5, I wanted to be a heart attack when I grew up.
Okay. Well, subliminal messaging, cardiology. Okay, I see it. Who should we interview next?
Andrew Adams from Eli Lilly. He's had a fantastic, unique career trajectory, and I think he'd have some interesting stories.
Andrew, thanks for joining us on Transcribe. That was a fantastic conversation.
Oh, thanks for having me, Saji. It's so much fun to come visit you at Benchling, and great conversation.
That's it for this episode of Transcribed. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe. To nominate future guests, drop us a note at transcribed@benchling.com. See you next time.